hurt over and over and over again, and then, like you, signing your IRS form, anytime they go on welfare, they have signed away their freedom. They've agreed. That signature is a capitulation. That treaty is a capitulation that allows the government to hold authority over anyone they benevolently shower gifts on. And then we need to turn and look at some other rather interesting turns of events. The Princess Diana El-Fayed debacle, it will go on as a distractor for quite some time. You'll find the monarchy trying to ease its way back in by smiling to the people, and you're going to see the people love it. And you will get sick to your stomach because you will say, what is mankind thinking about? They were just weeping and railing against the monarchy, and now they're groveling again. That's life. That's the way it is. And I think if you will promise to read what I have written for the paper, because we're going to start on another nasty, rotten series of informative articles, and I'm going to throw in a lot of things about, Transparency International, Prince Philip's little whingding. You see, while Mother Lizzie has been busy, so has Prince Philip. He just consorted everywhere, not just with her. So let's look forward to that. I have to protect the interests of the ones who sent that information, so you may never get a good resource on that one. But the other things, we're trying to work very, very closely with EIR, and their phone calls back and forth just a couple of times a week. A lot of information coming out of there. I'm not interested in Lyndon LaRouche any more than I am any other candidate running for power. And I recommend highly their magazines, their journals, their special reports, but they are, of course, self-serving because they have a person they're pushing. Well, don't let the fact that somebody is being pushed ruin your ability to see. And I don't know, maybe what I should do is just let you read today's and we'll close this meeting. Because what is happening over in Africa and in some of those Asian states and in North Korea, they are literally killing off thousands and thousands of people through famine. And food cannot make it in there. And even your president, when everybody in the world gets on the get rid of the landmines for Princess Di kick, and all he'd have to do is sign in to look good, he won't let the U.S. even join with petition to get rid of landmines, because after all, you have to keep the anti-tank, anti-personnel mines along the Korean border between South and North to keep the North from taking over the South. The North is starving to death. And it keeps food supplies from rolling across that border. It is a sick, sad world. And you have to begin to look at it. And now articles are coming out that are giving confirmation to what I told you years ago. And I hope that you can, in your own right, take it as confirmation. Because it seemed outrageous then, and a few people would speak of these things, and it seemed daring. Now they're in reported journals. They are court cases now having either been dismissed or the parties found not guilty. Whatever is appropriate for the day. In the dark black countries, it isn't just genocide of the masses. It is individual torture, murder, maiming. I mean, look at these landmines and how many people, civilians and children, will never walk again because of them. these vicious little children. I think I'll do that. EJ, read that and we'll stop for the day. I don't want you sleeping well at night.
Sunday, September the 21st, 1997. Good for Mr. Turner. On the same day that Teddy Turner offered the United Nations $1 billion over a 10-year period and appealed to others to share up as well, a strange thing happened at the post office. The following article arrived, and it bears sharing with you, people who think this is a benevolent act. Turner doesn't want this money used in administration because of its corruption, but rather in the field where it can best be utilized. And 10 years? He said that he made the billion in less than 9 months, so is 10 years reasonable to give $1 billion for good causes? What is this sudden burst of charity? Well, it keeps the UN from folding its busted tent and closing its goodwill missions, perhaps. The following is the cover story from the New American, September 29, 1997. And while you study the incredible attitudes of your adult children in uniforms protecting the world of women and children, think hard about what might have gone wrong in your world and if God should do much of anything for the dying species of mankind. Also note that Somalia is mentioned, along with other less fortunate places where genocide is prevailing. Think at the least, Henry Kissinger Associates, because the structuring of the intent in such places is from the planning pens of Kissinger Associates, the corporation. Quoting, Beasts in Blue Berets. Quote, We are not going to achieve a new world order without paying for it in blood as well as in words and money, warned Arthur Schlesinger Jr. in the July-August 1995 issue of Foreign Affairs. Schlesinger had taken to the pages of the flagship journal of the CFR to vindicate the dubious proposition that the United Nations military represents the thin blue line dividing peaceful civilization from savagery, in short, our planetary police. But what happens when the planetary police run amok and become the agents of bloodshed? When local police abuse power, the abused have avenues of redress. From what body can those abused by the planetary police seek justice? The escalating scandal of unpublished atrocities committed by UN peacekeepers illustrates that the planetary police are beyond accountability. Quote, Perhaps our leaders should put the question to the people. What do we want the United Nations to be? Schlesinger wrote. Do we want it to avert more killing fields around the planet? Or do we want it to dwindle into impotence, leaving the world to the anarchy of nation states? Critics of the UN should eagerly embrace such a debate, provided that a copy of the above photograph is made available to all participants. First published in the United States on the cover of the June 24th issue of the left-wing weekly Village Voice, the photograph depicts two Belgian paladins of the New World Order giddily holding a Somali child over an open flame. Other series of photographs depict UN soldiers kicking and stabbing a Somali, and another soldier apparently urinating on the Somali's dead body. Yet another shows a Somali child being forced to drink salt water, vomit, and worms. A second group of photos, published in July 15th, Village Voice, shows the dead bodies of bound Somalis, what appears to be the work of a death squad. One atrocity, not caught on camera, involved the punishment of a Somali child by placing him in a metal container and withholding water from him for 2 days. Predictably, the relentless African heat killed a child. One Belgian UN soldier testified that it was a regular practice to use metal boxes as prison cells, and that other Somalis probably died similarly gruesome deaths.
You have to keep in mind, Belgium is a new central headquarters of the New World Order.
Heading, strangely silent. One might expect the photographs and first-person accounts of such atrocities to arouse public indignation against the UN's planetary police, just as the endlessly replayed videotape of the Rodney King arrest turned public opinion against the LA Police Department. Perhaps this is why the photographs have been all but invisible in the United States, and precious little media attention has been devoted to an examination of UN atrocities. Village Voice reporter Jennifer Gould came across the accounts of the Belgian atrocities while doing an earlier story about sexual harassment of female employees at UN headquarters. When I spoke with people at the UN, time after time I was told, "If you think it's bad here, you ought to see what happens in peacekeeping operations," Gould told the New American. I started looking into that issue and found that the abuses I reported were well known and easily documented. They were all over the media abroad, and I was really surprised it hadn't been written about over here. Belgian military authorities launched an investigation into the atrocities following publication of a front-page story by Belgium's Het Leest News. In early July, Privates Claude Beert and Kurt Kolisch, the two paratroopers photographed dangling the Somali child over a flame, were acquitted by a military court, which ruled that the incident, described by Beert and Kolisch as a punishment for stealing, was a, quote, form of playing without violence.
I'm sure the child loved it.
According to prosecutor Luke Wallen, and what of discipline from the UN, whose code of personal conduct for blue helmets requires that peacekeepers, quote, respect and regard the human rights of all. Gould reports that a UN spokesman dismissed the acquittal of Beert and Kolisch by insisting that, quote, the UN is not in the habit of embarrassing governments that contribute peacekeeping troops. For its diligence in reporting unwelcome news, Hate-Laced News was rewarded with a bomb threat. Reporter Lee Van Ballester informed the New American that the man arrested for making the threat owned a local bar that is frequented by many people in the military, including veterans of peacekeeping missions. He apparently had been angered by what he had read. Ballester observed dryly, "We've enhanced our security here at the paper, and the police took the threat seriously, even though he may have been drunk when he made it." He claimed not to remember phoning in the threat when he was arrested. In September, another military tribunal will be held to investigate the actions of Sergeant Dirk Nasel.
Oh, let me interrupt again. This is off the subject, but relative to it. And you're going to have to deal with some of these things even when you're considering accidents such as the Diana Doty thing and how much the other bodyguard can't remember. Well, he went through 10 hours of adjunctive surgery, one thing, and if he has any brains at all, he will never remember anything. So let's start there. But there are drugs, and they're in your own ability to get them. I think some of them are called roofies, and this is usually it'll usually come out in date rape. A man and a woman will meet, or they'll go out, or they'll encounter one another, and he puts a little roofie in her drink. She never realizes it. She doesn't remember anything when she wakes up. She will only remember up until right then that she was there and they were having a nice time, and now here she is awake. She has no recollection whatsoever of anything happening. So depending on the condition of the party, the next morning or the next day or the next hour, there will be a great surprise to find out that possibly she's been raped. There are drugs that put into a drink. There will be no conscious memory of having them at all. And this is the very basis on which many have condemned O.J. Simpson. Did he actually do that under the influence of something that so warped his mind that he doesn't even remember doing it, that he would say to anybody under any circumstances, "I dreamt I killed her," and literally being afraid to take a lie detector because truth is in the subconscious mind? But you can train the subconscious mind. So you have a double blind, a real miserable problem here. And this is going to happen more and more and more. As drugs become more and more prevalent, they will change. And their actions on the body will change. Many of the drugs make people entirely, just outrageously aggressive. And then they won't remember. and it's legitimate. They don't remember. And when you have a situation where you have whole military peacekeeping troops being allowed to be exposed to this, an open and free run of drugs and prostitution and all the things that are considered taboo in a society and immoral in a society are totally acceptable. This is going to get more and more prevalent. Go on with that.
In September, another military tribunal will be held to investigate the actions of Sergeant Dirk Nessel, the soldier photographed forcing a Somali boy to ingest worms and vomit. However, the Belgian military system, which is deeply entwined with the UN peacekeeping apparatus, has yet to inflict substantive penalties for abuses committed in the service of the UN. Several years ago, according to Gould, Belgian soldiers were also accused of holding mock executions for Somali children and forcing them to dig their own graves.
Isn't this outrageous?
Though their officer was given a suspended sentence, the soldiers were acquitted. It is thus firmly established in Belgian military jurisprudence that service in the New World Army is a license to commit barbarities with impunity. Hathon has a comment here. Well, those are a long way from home, so what about others in the position of this type of play? Canadian-Italian atrocities. Nor was the Belgian component of the UN's Operation Restore Hope uniquely barbarous. Three members of a now-disabled elite Canadian paratroop regiment were tried and convicted of criminal charges in the beating death of a 16-year-old Somali boy named Shidane Aron. The three peacekeepers had been photographed smiling beside the bloody corpse of the boy, whose hands had been bound. The incident prompted the creation of a Canadian government commission to review that nation's military and its involvement in peacekeeping missions. However, the inquiry foundered on the obstructionism of political and military bodies and produced what Canadian critics call an incomplete and inadequate report. On August the 8th, Italian military officials admitted that Italian soldiers assigned to UN duty in Somalia had also tortured and otherwise abused Somali civilians. According to the Washington Post, quote, two generals who had led the Italian forces to Somalia resigned in June following publication of graphic reports of sexual violence against a Somali woman, electric torture of a young man, and allegations that an officer had murdered a young boy. Drugs and prostitutes also were allowed to circulate freely among Italian UN troops. The Italian government assembled a five-member commission of inquiry, which interviewed 145 people and traveled to Africa to interview Somalis who had been tormented by UN troops or witnessed the bestial acts firsthand. The panel's 46-page report documented that the criminal events were not just the result of rotten apples that you may find in any structure, but were rather the consequence of a stretched line of command and amused compliance toward such hijinks by some junior officers. The January 18th New York Times reported that 47 Canadian UN troops who served in Bosnia were accused of drunkenness, sex, black marketeering, and patient abuse at a mental hospital they were guarding. The soldiers had been assigned the humanitarian chore of guarding a mental hospital at Bakoviki in order to secure it for the staff's return. The hospital instead became the setting for heavy drinking, sex between soldiers, nurses, and interpreters that violated regulations, black market sales, and harassment of the patients. During the frenzy of looting that broke out in Liberia in the spring of 96, peacekeepers used UN vehicles to make off with pilfered goods, according to the April 12th issue of USA Today. UN vehicles and the troops responsible for them have also been a boon to Balkan drug smugglers. The August 9th, 96 Washington Times reported that U.S. and Bosnian officials suspected high-ranking UN officials from Jordan, based in the central Bosnian towns of Bugajino and Travnik, have routinely provided UN vehicles to help smugglers get contraband past checkpoints. The officers appear to have received money and their services of prostitutes from the smugglers, led by Islamic foreigners who entered Bosnia with U.S. approval to defend the Muslim government. Significantly, the Bosnian narco ring apparently received critical support from UN police monitors who were stationed in the Balkans in order to facilitate the creation of a civilian police force dedicated to upholding world law. A Pentagon official told the Washington Times that such problems were predictable, given that the International Police Task Force in Bosnia is a compendium of people from diverse countries with different degrees of professionalism and training and different backgrounds in operations and ethics, a fairly compelling explanation of why UN-style world law cannot work. Here's a comment by the commander. Okay, people, these are the ones that are now set forth to police your world, no matter who you are or where you might be in this old world. And these are the trained policemen set to take control through the United Nations. It has always been planned thusly, and terror is the best method of controlling people. Further, terror has to be based on base elements in order to get past the violent nature and acceptance of any society. Where do you think all of your own soldiers go? From the closed bases, etc.? Why, yes, of course, overseas to peacekeep so that they are unavailable to serve you, the people, but attend others while others' children are sent to control you, so that there is no softness allowed on the part of strangers in your own forces. Would your son shoot you? Disallowing the fact that this is getting to be more and more prevalent, we consider that a foreigner might well sooner shoot you than your own child. You mourn for weeks over a princess who is killed literally by living her own lifestyle and yet who attends these babes who are tortured to death by the very party sent to protect them. If you see nothing wrong with this, you are sicker than a whole lot of them. The UN's nation... End of commander's comment. The UN's nation-building mission in Cambodia, long touted as among the world's body's proudest achievements, added to that unfortunate land's abundant history of lawlessness. In 1993, 170 residents of Cambodia protested the abusive behavior of blue-helmeted troops in a letter to Yashushi Akashi, who served as then Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali's representative in Cambodia. Prominent among the complaints was the mistreatment of women who were treated to abuse and harassment by UN officials regularly in public restaurants, hotels and bars, banks, markets and shops. New York Times correspondent Barbara Crosset, whose primary beat is the UN, elaborated. The bad behavior of UN forces in Cambodia was not limited to abuse of women. There were bar fights, brawls and shootouts, and a proliferation of brothels, stolen vehicles, and general drunken boorishness. Geographical origins were no indicator of what to expect. While some Asian and African troops got out of line, it was the soldiers of a Bulgarian battalion who had the worst reputation. They went down in local legend as the Bulgarians. Cambodia has descended again into murderous chaos, and Kenneth Roth, executive director of Human Rights Watch, believes that, quote, the mess that Cambodia finds itself in today is in large part a product of the UN's failure to uphold the rule of law in the course of its nation-building mission. Heading, Nightmare in Rwanda. The same lawlessness infected the UN mission into Rwanda, which suffered a Cambodia-style genocide earlier this decade. Crosset noted that Rwandans accused UN troops of illicit trading, hit-and-run driving, sexual harassment, and criminal abuse of diplomatic immunity they have bestowed on themselves. The disruptive personal behavior of some troops has been a factor in Rwanda's demand that all peacekeepers be withdrawn from the country. End of quote. Also contributing to that demand is the fact that UN forces in Rwanda actually abetted the worst bloodletting in recent memory, the Rwandan genocide of 1994, in which a half a million Tutsis were annihilated in approximately 100 days. Many of the mass murderers were employees of the international relief agencies, testified Peter Hammond of Frontline Fellowship in the book Holocaust in Rwanda. In one incident recounted by Hammond, Belgian UN troops stationed in a heavily fortified compound in Kigali deceived the Tutsi refugees by assembling them for a meal in the dining hall, and then they evacuated the base while the refugees were eating. Literally 2 minutes later, after the Belgians had driven out of the base, the presidential guard poured into the buildings, annihilating the defenseless Tutsi refugees. When the Tutsi organized Rwandan Patriotic Front drove many of the worst Hutu murderers from Rwanda into the Congo, then called Zaire, the UN intervened militarily on the side of the murderers. 1 year after the genocide, wrote Peter Beinart in the October 30th, 95 issue of the New Republic, former Rwandan government militias, often armed and sometimes in uniform, control many UN refugee camps, terrorizing civilians and plotting to reinvade. Janet Fleshman of Human Rights Watch Africa reported, quote, the UN clearly took the lead in assisting these refugees who were in uniform and armed, and that helped them establish control over the refugee camps. This development provoked at the renowned French humanitarian group, goodness, I can't say that, Médecins Sans Frontières, and several other charitable organizations to withdraw from militia-controlled UN refugee camps. When the UN peacekeeping mission to Rwanda finally furled its blue banner in March 96, the reaction on the part of the Rwandans was one of unalloyed relief. Quote, hundreds of genocide survivors protested outside the UN headquarters in Kigali, cheered, as the UN flag was lowered to mark the end of the United Nations peacekeeping mandate, reported a March 3, 1996 Reuters wire service report. Apparently, Rwandans would rather face the prospect of bloody anarchy than submit to the variety of peace administered by UN troops. Another heading, follow the brothels. The market in prostitution, including child prostitution, thrives wherever blue berets decamp. According to Gold, records of UN peacekeeping missions documented that, quote, brothels have sprouted nearby, and in one case allegedly inside UN compounds. In the latter case, prostitutes were allegedly employed by the UN and were reportedly even shipped on UN planes to fornicate with a UN staff member in hotels paid for by the UN. Last December, a UN study on children in war reported that blue berets had been involved in child prostitution in 6 of the 12 countries which had been studied. In country after country, unfortunate enough to attract the UN's humanitarian intervention, the arrival of peacekeeping troops has been accompanied with a rapid rise in child prostitution, the document reported. Following the signing of a peace treaty in Mozambique in 1992, for example, quote, soldiers of the UN United Nations operation recruited girls aged 12 to 18 into prostitution. However, as Jennifer Gould learned, the mistreatment of women is something of a UN tradition. The world body's enthusiastic support for radical feminism notwithstanding. In a report published in the May 20th Village Voice, Gould described the plight of Catherine Claxon, a UN employee who filed the first ever sexual harassment complaint against the UN in 1991. After Claxon filed her complaint, quote, someone fired a shot through the glass window of a coffee shop by the United Nations, just above Claxon's head. Another bullet shattered Claxon's windshield as she drove home from her job at the UN one night on the Long Island Expressway. On 3 other occasions, Claxon was nearly run off the road at the same spot where she was nearly killed by the gunshot. According to Gould, quote, UN women describe a godfather-like institution, a network of cronyism and corruption. This is compounded by the fact that in some UN member countries, women are treated as chattel instead of as equals. Another heading, haunting prophecy. Gould described the UN as a bizarre universe of intrigue and outrage, where diplomats from 185 countries, stuffed suits simmering with regional religious and class-bred hatreds, try to promote world peace. Such is the character of the institution whose masters crave the power to enforce world law. The essence of that abstraction is captured in the photograph of peacekeepers Barrett and Collis playfully swinging a small child over a fire. Unaccountable power employed mercilessly against the helpless. More than 7 decades ago, while the U.S. Senate was debating ratification of the League of Nations Covenant, Senator William Borah Republican from Idaho, sought to cool the ardor of the League's supporters by dousing it with a bracing shower of cold reality. Those who believed that a world army would consist of stainless champions of world peace were ignoring the unyielding facts about human nature. A world army, Bora declared, would consist of, quote, the gathered scum of the nations organized into a conglomerate international police force ordered hither and thither by the most heterogeneous and irresponsible body or court that ever confused or confounded the natural instincts and noble passions of a people.
Let's stop. That's enough. You can finish reading it in the paper. The pictures are here for you to look at. They were brought so that Claudia could use them in the paper. If you want to go to the end where I make my comments, you may do that, and then we'll... Nobody's going to want to eat cake with this on your mind. I like a person who can separate business.
From cake?
From cake, yes.
Well, maybe I should start at the Moon Maidens. How many of you remember us writing last year about Bush going down to bless the Mooney installation in Venezuela? Well, Mr. Moon then went about the Bush business thinking himself beyond any reprobation of any man. He promptly brought into the country 3,000 to 4,000 Moon Maidens, prostitutes and programmed call persons. Word has it that he has been ordered out of and has been removed from the country. Is Bush's empire falling? Hard to say, isn't it? Let us close this, please, for we have a meeting this afternoon, and I would like this in this week's paper, if at all possible. I have so many topics to cover that we can hardly know where to begin, so don't think everything is peachy creamy just because we've been distracted to other duties. We will keep on keeping on until we can no longer do so, or we begin to find rewards for our service returning properly unto us. Thank you for being patient in these weeks of strained health and necessary focus on other circumstances. No, the sky is not falling, Henny Penny, but your enemies are just about to do so. In sincerest love and appreciation for that patience and understanding, I remain yours, Yorgos C. Hathon.
And I would like to repeat that. Thank you. And you are appreciated. You are cherished. And we're going to get our job done. So let's eat cake now. Salute.